Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Wanted, experienced CEO for major American retailer. Familiarity with data breaches and big box expansion misfires mandatory. Apply within Target Corporation, Minneapolis, Minnesota 55403. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl, the 5th of May today. Great, as always, to have you with us, gang. Not so great a day, however, for one Greg Steinhoffel, late of the Target Corporation. Mr. Steinhoffel was relieved of his duties this morning as chairman and CEO of the store sometimes called Target, now better known as the source of a massive breach of customer data. He was allowed to resign, technically. Bad as it was, that breach was simply the last straw for the Target board, as Dan Bobkoff explains.
It's not just the data breach that sealed Greg Steinhoffel's fate. Target is facing existential questions.
What is Target's real value in today's retail environment?
Rajiv Lal is a retailing expert at Harvard Business School. He says since Steinhoffel became CEO in 2008, Target's sales have struggled. Online competition is fierce. It spent a lot trying to get a toehold in Canada. And Lal says Target misfired trying to be more like a supermarket.
You can't really have a cachet in terms of design and in terms of fashion and at the same time sell food.
Plus, many other retailers now sell designer wares at Walmart prices. But since that data breach, sales have tumbled at Target even faster. Finding a better leader isn't always so easy, though.
It's costly to fire a CEO.
Luke Taylor is with the Wharton School, and he says over the last 20 years, top CEOs are getting fired more often, about 2% each year. But for companies like Target, it's expensive and unpleasant to search for someone new, and new ideas might not be an improvement.
Bringing on someone with a new vision is risky. Sometimes the risks pay off, sometimes they don't.
And Gary Nielsen of the consultancy Strategy And says many CEOs don't stay on the job long.
They can't come up with, you know, 8-year plans when you're talking more like 5-year turnover.
Target now has to find someone who can both restore customer confidence after the data breach and survive in retail, period. I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
This will come as news to those of us who've been afflicted by a computer virus, but the antivirus software business is apparently, and this is a quote, dead. One of the higher-ups at the maker of antivirus software, Norton, said that to the Wall Street Journal. And while acknowledging that I am woefully behind on my antivirus scans, can that possibly be true? Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith has that story.
In the world of large-scale data breaches, NSA spying, and phishing scams, does antivirus software really protect you against anything? Fran Roche is the Senior Vice President of Security Products and Services at Symantec.
We at Symantec and Norton have known that the era of AV-only protection has been dead for quite some time.
AV is short for antivirus. Roche says that's no longer enough to stop criminals. The new acronym in security?
ATPs, we like to call it. Advanced Threat Protection. We can see a file that's starting to do something really weird, like reaching into an address book. So we can then say, suspicious, block it right there.
If the old virus protection software was akin to building a wall around your computer, the new software takes a different approach, says Barrett Lyon, founder of Defense.net.
You want to make sure that the data on your computer isn't like the soft, gooey center any longer.
Take the Target data breach.
If that information was stored in a way that was encrypted and secured better, even though the bad guys got in, they would not be able to get to the actual information.
It's less about the computer and more about individual pieces of data. The data security industry is expected to balloon to $80 billion in the next few years.
Certainly the busiest time of my career, and I've been doing this for close to 20 years.
Chester Wisniewski is a senior security advisor at Sophos.
Many of these criminals are making millions of dollars a month, and with that kind of resource on the line, they're not going to roll over and lie down, right?
Which means the online security business, in one form or another, won't be dead anytime soon. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Also not dead, Wall Street, way down at the open, barely up at the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. About a year ago, a little more actually, we teamed up with the Chronicle of Higher Education to find out what companies want from today's college graduates. Number one with a bullet before grades or where you want to school is an internship. The bind those students are in, of course, is that the National Association of Colleges and Employers says about half of the internships last year's graduating seniors did while they were in school were unpaid. But as Marketplace's Amy Scott reports from the Education Desk at WYPR, that may well be changing.
Just how crucial is a summer internship these days? When I stopped by Columbia University in New York recently, almost every student I talked to either had one lined up or was working on it.
It's almost as required as like the core classes here. If you're not taking internships over the summer, you're just getting behind.
Keenan Piper, a pre-med freshman from Seattle, plans to do a research internship back home at the University of Washington, most likely unpaid. Junior Ethan Ling has lined up a coveted paid gig in Hong Kong after working for free last summer full-time at a venture capital firm.
I just had to do it just to, you know, beef up my resume. I think in the job market, like, you just have to do what you have to do to, you know, get a job at the end of the day.
Ling got by on savings. But not everyone can afford to work for free. Freshman Brittany Wade is looking for a position in PR.
I tend to sort of breeze over the ones that don't pay because I don't think it's really fair. Like, yes, we are doing it for an experience and that is valuable to us, but I don't think there should be like free labor like enforced when it comes to internships.
Last spring, a federal judge threw water on the long tradition of the unpaid internship. He ruled that Fox Searchlight Pictures had broken the law by failing to pay interns who did the work of paid employees. The ruling forced employers everywhere to rethink their policies. Mikey Franklin is founder of the Fair Pay Campaign to end unpaid internships.
Anytime you post an ad for an unpaid internship, you're writing, poor people need not apply, in big letters at the top.
If the fairness argument hasn't been persuasive, the threat of lawsuits has been. Magazine publisher Condé Nast just settled a suit brought by some of its former unpaid interns. The company shut down its internship program altogether. Many other companies, from Viacom to the New York Times to the nonprofit Lean In, have opted to pay at least minimum wage.
So we're seeing a gradual move towards paid internships and away from unpaid internships. But the culture of unpaid internships is deeply ingrained.
And here's where I have to come clean. Though Marketplace pays all of its interns, I myself hired one last summer to work unpaid on my own project, a documentary film. Like many interns, she got college credit. But that practice is under fire, too. Recently, Columbia announced it would no longer give credit for internships. Other schools have stepped up their oversight.
All that Columbia giving this credit did was enable employers to offer unpaid internships and say that, well, they get credit, so it must be legal.
Columbia senior Peter Stern runs a website tracking who pays interns and how much. As more companies start paying, he says there will probably be fewer positions to go around. That may be happening already. The National Association of Colleges and Employers tracks internships in an annual survey. The group's Edwin Koch says typically he sees at least a 5% increase every year, even when the economy's bad. This year,
we saw no real increase in the number of internships available this year as opposed to last year, whereas there should be a substantial increase at this point.
That has colleges nervous. They're under a lot of pressure to produce employable graduates who land good jobs. But without a paycheck, an internship may only get those graduates so far. Koch's group found that students who did paid internships were far more likely to have at least one job offer by graduation than those who worked for free. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
In about, 3 minutes or so, you're going to hear a couple of bars of music and then the day's numbers from Wall Street, the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P. There are, of course, a zillion ways to look at the markets, one of which is sometimes called the fear index. Sally Herships explains.
Let's talk about the Chicago Board Options Exchange Volatility Index. Luckily, it's also known as the VIX.
Basically, it's just a fancy name for what the market views as in terms of risk going forward.
So when the markets are going down, the VIX is going up. Eric Augustin is with Wells Fargo Private Bank.
Well, the VIX, you know, I sometimes look at it as a little bit as a temperature.
The temperature of fear, the downgrading of U.S. credit, the debt ceiling, Russia's presence in Ukraine. When things are uncertain, the VIX jumps. It's a measurement of the price of calls and puts, a complicated way investors try to hedge their bets. This week, it's around 13.
Back in 2008, the VIX went from 14 to 80.
So the VIX looks at the price of the insurance that investors are buying. Here's why it matters. Remember the beginning of The Wizard of Oz?
It's a twister! It's a twister!
Dorothy's house gets picked up by a tornado, and she gets blown to Oz. The VIX is like a weather report. If Auntie Em or Uncle Henry had been able to check it, they might have known tornado season was coming up.
If you think about the situation with Dorothy, Dorothy really cares about insurance when the wind is blowing. And the VIX give us a picture and a forecast for how the wind is going to blow.
Chris Gatesy teaches finance at Wharton. He says, remember, the VIX is forward-looking. Most methods of measuring the markets use data from the past.
Oh, so Auntie Em and Uncle Henry, if they had known that the twister was coming, they could have bought insurance on their house.
That's a possibility. They'd have to work very fast, though, because the weather was coming in.
Which means last-minute insurance would be a lot more expensive. But Gatesy says if Dorothy had been watching the VIX, she would have known what the weather was going to do. And at least she would have had some options. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up,
pro football by 2-1 is the most popular sport in this country. Every viewer poll shows it.
Money or concussions, you decide. But first, let's do the numbers. So there were some morning jitters, as I said. The Dow Industrials finished up a 10%. Anywho, 17 points closed at 16,530. The NASDAQ gained a 1/3 of 1%, 14 points, finished at 4,138. The S&P 500 added a 10%. 3 points, ended things at 1884. Target's decision to replace its CEO didn't do much for Wall Street. Shares in the giant retailer fell 3.5%. Today seems the CEO isn't the company's only problems, as Mr. Bob Goff was telling us. And from the Cinco de Mayo economy, PepsiCo, owner of Frito-Lay, maker of Doritos, was up 0.4%. Anheuser-Busch InBev, owner of Grupo Modelo, maker of Corona, up 1%. Yum Brands, parent of Taco Bell, gained about 0.1%. In the bond markets, prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note thus rose to 2.60%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department lets us know what the trade deficit was in March. The Senate Armed Services Committee holds a hearing on military compensation. And it's International No Diet Day. Plan ahead, people. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. If your kid goes to public school, there's a real good chance that their teacher doesn't look like them. There's a pair of studies out, one from the Center for American Progress, the other from the National Education Association, that shows while about half of public school students in this country are kids of color, 4 out of 5 teachers are white, quite unlike the much more diverse workforces those kids will be entering in just a couple of years. Marketplace's Noel King has the story.
There are several reasons for the current lack of diversity among teachers. A few decades ago, if you were black, there were very few paths to the middle class. When LaRuth Gray was growing up in Texarkana, Texas in the 1950s...
You either became a teacher, a funeral parlor director, you worked as a railroad porter where you got good tips. In terms of economics, that's where you went in order to provide a step and a ladder up for your family.
Gray is a scholar in residence at NYU's Metropolitan Center for Research on Equity and the Transformation of Schools.
The next generation, my daughter and that generation, they're lawyers, doctors, economically. In the next generation, I can do all kinds of things. I don't have to be a teacher.
So, progress. But for students, there's a problem. Ulrich Boser of the Center for American Progress is co-author of one of the new studies.
If you were to walk into a school today, the teaching workforce in many places would look like it had meandered out of the 1950s. It's overwhelmingly white.
Bozer says diversity is important for two reasons.
Students of color do much better in terms of academic outcomes with teachers of color. They see them as role models. Student achievement, graduation rates, test scores all go up.
But also,
it's important for white students to engage with Hispanic teachers, to engage with black teachers, because the world of work is a world in which we have to engage and cooperate and communicate well with people who come from different backgrounds.
He says if schools are going to prepare kids for the real world, they should look like the real world. I'm Noelle King for Marketplace.
The NFL draft starts Thursday night. It's a big deal for players, of course, and the teams that draft them. For fans, too, I suppose. But forget not here the agent, the representative who negotiates, cajoles, and sometimes cares for that 21-year-old kid who all of a sudden has more money than he knows what to do with. Lee Steinberg knows exactly what that day is like. He's been a sports agent for 40 years. He's represented the number one pick in the NFL draft 8 times, and he has got some stories to tell. His memoir is called The Agent. Lee, it's great to have you with us.
My pleasure.
The greatest sports agent in history, it says right on the cover here from Forbes magazine. That's quite something.
I think it's a testimony to longevity.
Yeah, well, 40 years, right? I mean, that's a long time.
I began in 1975 as I was a dorm counselor back at UC Berkeley, and they moved the freshman football team into the dorm.
And a guy named Steve Bartkowski
was one of my counselees, and Bart asked me to represent him, and there was a World Football League competing with an NFL then, so we had leverage, and we got the largest rookie contract in NFL history. It eclipsed Joe Namath and O.J. Simpson, and that's how it began.
And Steve Bartkowski goes on to sign with the Falcons, yeah.
He does.
As much as this is your memoir, right, it's a story of change in the National Football League and sports and society in this country. And in fact, your subtitle here, your 40-year career making deals and changing the game. How did it come to pass, and baseball purists will object here, but how did it come to pass that football has become the sports business in this country instead of baseball?
I think it's a combination of the growth of television and football together. So all the great camera angles, all the most amazing ways to televise it. Then it's an event once a week so that people can build up to it. Football reflects those tight bites of action that
plays to the American sensibility, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Is that sustainable, though? I mean, the NFL's got some challenges, right? And you've done a lot of work on concussions and player safety. Profitability is high, but seat and ticket prices are high and rising, you know.
But they fill the stadia. So pro football by 2-1 is the most popular sport in this country. Every viewer poll shows it. There were weeks last year where 3 of the top 5 Nielsen-rated shows were nighttime NFL football.
This is going to sound like a funny thing to ask a sports agent, but is there too much money in sports?
If you asked me the concept of worth, I would tell you that my father, who was a high school principal and a school teacher, and people that are nurses and people that are emergency personnel and policemen and, again, especially teachers, should be valued more by the society. I believe that. We're not putting bread and butter on the table in professional sports. We're not providing transportation to work. But it's supply and demand, and the system is set up so that the revenue flows into certain occupations, and they're handsomely compensated.
Your kids are grown. I don't know if you have any grandchildren yet, but would you let them play football?
I had no luck with my two boys stopping them from playing high school football. I think that concussion is an existential threat to football. I had a crisis of conscience back in the 80s. I saw my players getting hit in the head. We'd go to doctors. Doctors couldn't tell us how many were too many and what the long-term ramifications were. I started to hold concussion seminars to make sure my players at least got to hear the neurologist. What makes this different than any other injury is it affects rationality, consciousness, memory, and what it means to be a human being. Now, you ask players, they will always tell you they would do it again, even with their injuries.
Lee Steinberg, his book is called simply The Agents. Thanks a lot for coming in.
My pleasure.
We've got a series we've been doing for a little while now. Your questions answered by our reporters. It's called I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder.
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer. By brain work and blade work.
Today's question comes to us from Carol Shearer of Eagle River, Alaska. It is, I'm told, about 10 miles north of Anchorage. And here you go. Why, she wonders, do green olives and Kalamata olives come in jars, but black olives come in cans? Why, indeed? Marketplace's Dan Weissman has the answer.
Carol says this started as an economic question. In the grocery store, she needed black olives, but not a whole can.
I got wondering, why can't you buy black olives in a jar like you can the other kind?
There's actually a great story here, but it took some digging. First, journalist Mort Rosenblum wrote the book on olives, The Olive, Life and Lore of a Noble Fruit. I asked him, why cans for black olives, jars for greens and Kalamatas?
You know, that's a really wild question, which I don't think I can answer.
He's willing to guess.
Green olives are kind of attractive. You know, they have that kind of nice color to them.
And black olives are ugly? Nope. Actually, they came in glass jars, too, once upon a time. Okay, time to head into the field. Let's go to Italy. No flight necessary. Italy, spelled E-A-T, is a high-concept Italian food complex that just opened a branch here in Chicago. Dave Malzahn is a manager in the Salumi Formaggi department, which includes the olive bar with olives from all over Italy.
These dark guys right over here, these are Gaeta from the Lazio region.
I ask Dave the question. He says, I'm in the wrong place.
If you're thinking about the olives that when you were at grandma's house, you wore on your fingers on Thanksgiving, oh, no, those guys we do not carry.
Why not? Dave says, Italy isn't just about eating. Italy is about knowing the story of what you're eating.
What's inside those cans with those black olives? Not much story there.
Actually, there's a great story. Let's meet the person who knows it best.
My name is Judith Taylor. I'm a retired physician. In 2000, I published a book called The Olive in California.
The black olive, also known as the California ripe olive, was invented in Oakland by a German widow named Frieda Ehmann. In the mid-1890s, all she had was an olive grove nobody thought was worth very much.
She must have been a truly amazing and remarkable woman, because instead of just sitting in her daughter's rocking chair in Oakland, she got very busy and decided she would pick the olives and do something with them.
She got a recipe from the University of California for artificially ripening olives. Green olives are pickled green, as in not ripe. Frieda perfected her recipe, sold her olives locally, then went east, opened up new markets. She scored her first hit in Philadelphia and eventually had a national business. And she kept going back to the U of C for more tips, including packaging.
When she went to Philadelphia, the olives were in kegs and barrels, you know, which is just kind of loosely covered. They're not sealed.
Then glass jars. They don't spill.
Yes, and they're very pretty. And gradually they developed the technique of sealing the jars effectively. And with that came trouble.
You seal the jar, and what's inside?
That's perfect culture medium for botulism.
In 1919, olive-related botulism outbreaks started killing people, capped by a 1924 outbreak involving Frieda Ehmann's olives.
There was a period of about 10 years when no one would even look at an olive from California. It was just like a death warrant.
The whole industry switched to a new standard for the ripe California olive.
It has to be heated to over 240 degrees. So only a can tolerate that physically. You couldn't do that to a glass jar.
Eventually, California olives came back in cans. But Ehmann had long since retired. She was heartbroken.
She couldn't come to terms with the fact that something she had done had actually killed people.
Okay. Carol Shearer of Alaska, how'd we do?
Boy, I just had absolutely no idea. Well, that's really cool.
Yes. Thank you for asking that one. In Chicago, I'm Dan Weissman for Marketplace.
If you've got something you've always wondered, you can write to us. Letters at marketplace.org is email, or you can tweet us at Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today, about which you might well say, hey, cool, and whoa, too much information all at the very same time. Match.com, the dating website, is celebrating its upcoming 20th anniversary with a college scholarship program for the kids that it helped make, if you take my meaning. In other news, Match.com has been around for 20 years. How did that happen? All right, we're done. We got to go. That is Marketplace from 8 p.m. on this Monday. Today, the Dow up about a 10%, 16,530 for the blue chips. The NASDAQ gained a third of 1%, 4,138. The S&P 500 added a mere 10%, ended things at 1,884. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, Millie Jefferson, and Melissa Yeager-Miller. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is 8 p.m.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.